October 24, 2009.
Okay, we'll begin with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. I just want to make a couple of brief announcements before we start. If anybody hasn't yet given their contact address, email address, to Kaiti, then please do so, so that if there's any announcement connected with the class, if for some reason suddenly it has to be canceled, then she'll inform everybody by email. And also, for those who don't have the book, the text of the suttas are being put up on the BAUS, the Buddhist Association of the United States website. Of course, I recommend that you purchase the book. But if you're just sort of trying the class out, you can get the suttas on the website, photocopied, scanned in. Okay, we are doing sutta number 2 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Sabhasava Sutta, the discourse on all the asavas, the taints, inflows, outflows, influences, leakages, stream flows. Okay, so last time we got through paragraph number 6 about how the what's called the uninstructed worldling or untaught worldly person, common person, ordinary person, doesn't practice wise attention. He attends to things unwisely, and because he does so, these unarisen taints arise in him, and the arisen taints increase and expand. And as I explained last time, there are 3 basic taints, 3 asavas, which I interpret to mean the primordial defilements that are at the base of the round of birth and death. And this is the I don't like to use the word taint, but the leakage, you could say, of sensual desire, the leakage of craving for existence, and the leakage of ignorance. Okay, so now we come to paragraph 7. So because the worldly person doesn't attend properly to the things that come within the range of his experience, then he falls into this kind of perplexed reflection about his own excuse me. Perplexed reflection about his own existence. So this is how he attends unwisely. Was I in the past? Did I exist in the past? Was I not in the past? Didn't I exist in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? So these are five kinds of reflections about the past, and five kinds of reflections about the future. Shall I be in the future? Will I continue to exist? Shall I not be in the future? Maybe I won't exist in the future. That is, in an afterlife. What shall I be in the future? What will I be in my next life? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Okay, so five kinds of perplexed reflection about the future. Or else he starts reflecting unwisely about the present. Am I? In other words, do I exist? Do I not exist? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So what is common to all of these reflections about past, future, present? Despite their diversity, there's something common to all of them. Excuse me? Yeah, well, it's not yet like... Try it. How do I get out of it? It's timely, I'm speaking about the trap of the view of self, and here I am trapped in this piece of equipment. Yeah, that's one way to do it, is to take this thing off. Okay, great. No, that's the other. Okay. Okay, so at this point, the view of self is not yet crystallized, not yet established, but you're on the right track, that all of these reflections revolve around some idea that there is an I persisting through past, present, future. And so what it seems to be the case is that we could say that these kinds of perplexed reflections, we could say that they are pregnant with the view of the self, but it's not yet come to the surface. But he's starting to think, because he's reflecting unwisely, so he falls into this, let's say his thoughts all revolve around the idea of an I or a self. And so now once he starts reflecting in this way, trying to answer these questions, eventually he will come upon a full-fledged view of the self. Okay, so that's why in paragraph 8 it says, when he attends unwisely in this way, one of six views arises in him. Okay, the first view is the view that the self exists for me. I have a self. This arises in him as something true and established. It seems to be a valid view of self. Or else the view, no self exists for me. In other words, I don't have a self. I don't have any kind of permanent self. This view arises in him as true and established. And according to the commentary, we could say that the first view, the view that that I have a self, that the self exists for me, this is a view which is inclining in the direction of what is called eternalism, the view that I have a permanent, everlasting self. So it's not yet stated fully and explicitly, but that view is leaning in that direction. On the other hand, the view no self exists for me, or I have no self, Superficially, this seems like the Buddhist doctrine of non-self, but actually it's not the same. This is taken to be the view of what's called annihilationism, the view that identifies the person simply with the physical body and says that there's no kind of principle of continuity within the individual, that we just exist as an assemblage of material elements. And then when the body perishes, everything comes to an end. The plug is pulled out and everything comes to an end. And so this is different from the Buddhist view of non-self, which is not really so much the way I understand it, the assertion, I don't have a self, but rather it's the expressed with the formula that all the phenomena that make up the person are not self, which means that when we look at these phenomena, the five aggregates, six elements, 12 sense bases, and so on, when we examine them, we find that they don't measure up to the criterion of a self. So it's not a dogmatic or doctrinal assertion, there is no self, but it's, I would call it, a guide to examination and investigation in order to see that the phenomena that make up our individual identity don't have the qualities or characteristics of a true self. Okay, so that is the second view. Then the third view, I perceive, let's take the third, fourth, and fifth views are quite closely related. And the way I see it, these three views all devolve around the fact that the human mind is capable of self-reflection, that we can turn back and reflect on ourselves and examine ourselves. And so there's a kind of split within human consciousness between what I would call an observing portion and the observed portion. For example, if you sit in meditation practicing citta-nupassana, contemplation of mind, you'll see that one part of the mind is simply looking, examining, or is aware. And then the other part of the mind is sort of flowing by like the scenes in a cinema film. Different thoughts, ideas, memories, plans. So that is the observed portion. The awareness is the observing portion. And so now these three views are all trying to locate a self in relation to this split in human consciousness. So the first of these views, view number three, identifies the self with both portions, both the observing portion and the observed of the self. So he takes the view, I perceive self, that's the observed portion, with self, that's the observing portion. So that view arises as true and established. Or else the view, I perceive not self with self, arises as true and established. In this case, one will hold that all of these thoughts, ideas, emotions, feelings, plans, projections, flowing by, that is not the self. But that which is observing, that which is aware, that light of awareness, that is the self. Maybe this is at least one of the views being articulated in texts like the Upanishads. Okay, the third of these positions is the view, I perceive self with not self arises in him as true and established. Maybe this view will hold that the content of the mind is a real self, and that which is observing the content of the mind is maybe just a purely, just a pure light of awareness, but it's not the self. Maybe this would be a view, perhaps it would correspond with some of the views of the early psychoanalytical theory, Freudian theory. I'm just guessing, I'm not an expert in this. But the view that holds that what the true person is, this would be the id. One's real identity is the id, and that which is aware, the ego, is just the kind of reflection or function of the deep underlying structures of the psyche. Please don't quote me though as an authority and say that Bhikkhu Bodhi is holding this interpretation of Buddhist interpretation of psychoanalytical theory. I'm just offering this as a kind of a guess. Okay, so this is the fifth view. The sixth view, this is the full-fledged view, the eternalist view. We find some expressions of this in the literature of the Upanishadic literature, even maybe texts like Bhagavad Gita. He has some such view as this. It is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and it will endure as long as eternity. So you can see that this is a fully explicit assertion that there is an eternal self, a self that's everlasting. And so, for example, the Bhagavad Gita speaks about the Atman, or self, as like a person who might have a closet full of different clothes, and so one day the person will wear one suit of clothes, the next day he wants to change the clothes, he'll take those off, put on a new suit of clothes, the next day put on another suit of clothes, and yet he always remains the same person. And so in this analogy, the person who remains the same is like the self or the soul, and the suits of clothes, are like the physical bodies, the different incarnations. So just as the person changes the clothes while remaining the same person, so the Atman, as it moves from life to life, it casts off one body, takes on another body, but it always remains the same Atman, the same self. Okay, so then the Buddha speaks about the danger or the drawback in these views of self. Of course, these views of self form the first of the 10 fetters. These are all different forms of what's called Sakkaya Ditti, personal identity view, which is the first fetter binding beings to the cycle of birth and death. So the Buddha says this speculative view is called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. Fettered by this, by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person, the worldly person, is not freed from birth, aging, and death, not freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He is not freed from suffering, I say. Okay, and now the Buddha is going to show the contrasting section where we have the well-taught, noble disciple This is the disciple, one who is the disciple of the noble ones. And so this person has regard for the noble ones, and he is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma. He has regard for the true men or the good persons. Again, that's just a synonym for the noble ones. And he is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma. This one understands what things are fit for attention, what things should be attended to, and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, and he attends to those things fit for attention. Again, as I mentioned last week, according to the commentary, there's not a sharp distinction between things fit for attention and things unfit for attention. What is crucial, rather, is the way one attends to things. And so the untaught worldly person attends to things in the improper way, looking at things in a way that will bring increased gratification, sensual pleasure, fulfill his longings and desires, whereas the instructed noble disciple will view things with wisdom, seeing things accurately in a way that will lead to disenchantment and to liberation. And so then the Buddha raises the questions, what are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to? They are the things that when he attends to them, the unarisen taints the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to, they are the things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taints arise and the arisen taints increase. And then what are the things fit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taints do not arise and the arisen taints are abandoned. And this is elaborated for each of the three taints. Okay, then the Buddha shows the key way in which the noble disciple attends wisely. That is, he attends wisely using as the framework for attention the Four Noble Truths. And so he attends wisely, this is suffering. He attends wisely, this is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely, this is the cessation of suffering. And he attends wisely, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So this is, we could say, the basic template for contemplation that the noble disciple, or the wise instructed disciple, uses. And so what he'll have accessible to him immediately as a framework for contemplation would be the first noble truth. He begins by examining things in terms of, say, the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and anatta, non-self. So beginning by attending to things wisely in this way, then he will eventually launch into the development of insight, the practice of insight meditation directed towards the three characteristics. So he'll be seeing more and more deeply how all conditioned phenomena are possessed of or stamped with these three characteristics. Then applying the template of dependent origination, he will seek what is the cause for the coming into being of these phenomena. And he'll see that these phenomena arise basically through craving and ignorance. It's craving and ignorance that bring into being from life to life these five aggregates that sustain them. And then as long as they continue, again they bring the suffering of the round of rebirths. And so investigating the first two noble truths, exploring them with insight, eventually there comes a point. At this stage of insight, he'll know by inference that if craving and ignorance can be eliminated, then all suffering comes to an end. And he'll have trust that the Noble Eightfold Path is the way to the cessation of suffering. Then as he goes on investigating with insight, a point comes where he makes the breakthrough to direct experience of the truth of the Dhamma, the transcendent truth of the Dhamma. Then he sees directly the third noble truth, which is Nibbana, the unconditioned. And that gives him the platform from which to know the third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and to know that in fact this Noble Eightfold Path is the way to the cessation of suffering. And so this is the breakthrough experience to the stage of what is called stream entry, entering the stream of the Dhamma, so that one is heading irreversibly in the direction of full liberation. And so therefore the Buddha says, when he attends wisely in this way, when he attends properly in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him. These three fetters are, here I translated personality view, later I changed to identity view. This is the view of a self existing in relation to the five aggregates. So with this breakthrough to the Dhamma, experience of the Dhamma, one cuts off, one sees into the selfless nature of all phenomena. And with that, any possibility of adopting a view of self is abandoned. So one never can adopt any kind of view that asserts the existence of a real self existing in relation to the five aggregates. So he cuts off the fetter of identity view, and now he's seen the truth of the Dhamma, and so he has no more doubt, because now he sees the same truth that the Buddha has seen. And so he has what's called unwavering confidence. And he cuts off what's called silabhata paramasa, here translated adherence to rules and observances. Maybe adherence is not so satisfactory, since it suggests that somebody who gains the first stage of enlightenment doesn't have to follow rules, but could just do what he wants. I think the better translation for paramasa might have been wrong grasp. It's grasping rules and observances with the idea, just by following these rules, undertaking these observances, I can gain enlightenment and liberation. Okay, because now the disciple has seen that the Noble Eightfold Path is the way to liberation. So he won't adhere, he won't wrongly grasp the rules and observances, especially some of the ascetic self-tormenting practices that were popular during the Buddha's time. Okay, now it said these are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. This is a little bit problematic because, or at least I consider this to be a little bit problematic, because in the earlier part of the discourse, the Buddha speaks about three taints. What are the three taints? The taint of sensuality, taint of craving for existence, and taint of ignorance. And the three fetters are not identical with any of the taints. So it seems to me, and this will be true later in the discourse too, that here the Buddha is using the word taints in a looser way than in the earlier paragraphs, where he's speaking technically about the three taints that are well defined in his teaching. The commentary accepts the idea of the later notion of dit-asava, the taint of wrong views. So in that understanding, personality view or identity view is one aspect of the taint of views, and the wrong grasp of rules and observances is also a taint of views. Because the wrong grasp of rules and observances is the view that simply by observing these rules and observances, one can gain enlightenment. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything that we've covered so far in the sutta. Okay. Way in the back.
Venerable one.
First take the microphone.
Venerable one. Yeah. Some would ask, if there is no self, what is it that accumulates karma?
Okay. Okay, first, I always have reservations about asserting the Buddhist position to be simply, there is no self. Because I don't know any text from the Nikayas which says simply and definitely, there is no self. It doesn't mean that I think that the Buddha is saying that there's some kind of indescribable self, but it's just that the teaching of non-self, the way we find it in the Nikayas, it's formulated differently. It's always the Buddha saying, this is not self, this is not self, this is not self. So he's always pointing to particular things and saying, this is not self. So this seems to be, the way I understand this, it's using this idea of non-self as a way to examine the different constituents of one's, that make up one's personal identity, and finding that these things that we usually identify as self don't measure up to the standards of self. And so there's a practical purpose underlying that way of explanation. When one sees that the things one takes to be a self are not self, then one gives up the clinging to them. It's a little bit, maybe to use an analogy, say we're in a dark place like a cellar, you're with it, and then you look down on the ground and you see a snake. Okay, then somebody is in the room with you and he says, there's no snake in the room. But you say, there is a snake. Then he says, no, there's no snake in the room. Then you just get into an argument whether there is a snake, whether there is not a snake. But supposing what you're taking to be the snake is a coil of rope on the ground, and the person that you're with, instead of saying there's no snake in the room, he says, examine that coiled up thing on the ground and you'll see it's not a snake. In that case, instead of getting fearful and getting angry and arguing with the person, you look on the ground and then you see, maybe you take a flashlight, you shine it on that coil of rope, that coiled up thing on the ground, and you see it's a piece of rope, not a snake. And then the illusion of snakehood disappears, and what is there appears as it is to be just a coiled up piece of rope. And so this is the way I understand the Buddha is using the teaching of non-self. The five aggregates are like the piece of rope. The idea of self that we normally superimpose on the five aggregates are like the idea of snake. And so we look at the five aggregates and closely with a focused mind, steadily, and then as we examine them, it turns out that they don't measure up to the mark of self. they're always arising and passing. And then one gives up the false interpretation of them as being the self. Wait, I'm not yet finished. Okay, so this is the way, first I would deal with that part of your question. If the Buddha says that there is no self, because so far as I know, the Buddha doesn't quite state that. The later interpreters of Buddhism do state it in that way. But if we look at the early text, there's a difference in emphasis. Okay, the second part of the question, if there is no self, how is karma accumulated? Okay, this is it's an interesting question. And the question is not explicitly answered in the early texts, but the way, let us say, Buddhist tradition, the early Buddhist tradition gives an answer, that karma is done. And when we use the image of accumulation, or the expression accumulation, it's, let us say, it's a way of speaking which has a kind of metaphorical flavor to it. So there's no place actually where karma is accumulated. When we think of karma being accumulated, we're using kind of a physical analogy to think of karma, as though karma were like grains of maybe pieces of fruit that one might pick up if you go to an apple orchard and pick up apples off the tree and put them in a basket. You're accumulating the apples in the basket. So we think of karma in that way, but this is just a metaphorical way of speaking. What we say is that when one does some kind of ethically significant action, one creates a karma, and that karma remains as a potency, a potentiality. That potentiality is created, I would say, in the field of one's consciousness. Again, I'm using a metaphorical expression. But that potentiality is there. It's an energy which is in some way present. It's not literally accumulated anywhere, though we could speak about accumulating karma. But that potentiality is there, waiting is metaphorical, but waiting for the suitable conditions to appear. And when those suitable conditions appear, the karma will produce its result. Okay, but the karma is not actually continuing to exist anyplace in a literal sense, but just the karma creates within our mind streams a potentiality to ripen in a particular way. And so that's always there, whether one knows it or not. And then once the conditions manifest, again, without any volitional control on our part, the karma will ripen and bring its result. Is that understandable?
I come from the notion of I comes from the Tibetan perspective, and in that perspective there is this essence that we speak of as the Bindu. And is that, when we talk about rebirth in the different realms, is there a continuity in that? Is that what you believe here, that there is some continuity, not necessarily the self, but that essence that, goes into these different realms?
Yeah, definitely there's a continuity. So the consciousness is, maybe you call it a stream or a process of occasions of consciousness, always arising, passing away, arising and passing away. But that consciousness flows on as a continuous stream. And so when death takes place, what happens is that the stream of consciousness can no longer arise based on the same physical body. but according to the karmic accumulations, hard to avoid that expression, according to the karmas that one has done and accumulated, that those karmas, we call these energies, potentialities, will direct the stream of consciousness to a sphere of rebirth which is appropriate for the karmic tendencies within that stream of consciousness.
So you call it consciousness.
Yeah, consciousness, we could say, is the factor, the main factor responsible for maintaining the continuity of the rebirth process. But strictly, it's not the same individual consciousness, like one entity that goes on preserving its identity, but it's a continuously changing stream or process of consciousness.
You mentioned the Bhagavad Gita and the notion of Atman as an everlasting self, and that is unwise thinking.
Is that what?
You said that was unwise thinking, the notion of an Atman. Was it that unwise thinking, the notion that there's an eternal self, that, and this is maybe the argument between Hinduism and Buddhism that's gone on forever.
Yeah.
But if someone comes from a Vedic tradition and believes that, does that make that unwise thinking?
This is something I don't make a judgment about. But I think looking at this from the Buddha, from the standpoint of the Buddhist text, the Buddha judges that as unwise thinking. But I don't like to pass judgment on other people's ways of thinking.
I have a question about the relationship between doubt and the Kinto views.
Yeah.
I think I understand how identity view and the wrong grasp of rites and rituals relates to identity view. Are the texts saying that doubt can't exist without a sense of self? I'm curious about the relationship of the fetter of doubt to identity view.
Mm. I know what is true is that the fetter of doubt and the fetter of the view of self are eliminated together. Whether doubt can exist without a view of self, I'm not sure actually. But there's some relationship between them. It seems that it's the doubts that give rise to the view of self, the way that's explained here. But I have to think about this. Yeah, please.
Now, as I understand this, there is a standard for the self, and the Buddha is taking different things from which selfhood claims are made, right? And he's saying, see, they don't measure up.
Right.
They can't, that is, none of them in themselves can be the self.
Yeah.
And if you try to lump them and say, well, all together, they're the self. Well, then that's an aggregate, which I guess can't be a self because it's a multitude.
Right.
But what I don't understand is, where does the standard for the self come from?
Yeah.
You see, if he's saying, well, they don't measure up to that standard.
Yeah.
Why is the standard more certain than the things that different people are making claims for? See, why can't the ordinary man say, well, it might be that myself doesn't measure up to your standard for a self, but it does a perfectly good job of measuring up to my standard.
My head's about to explode. It's very complicated stuff.
Anyway, that's a good question. Okay, first, what are the standards that the Buddha uses for the self? And it seems that he's not really setting his own standard for the self, or standard for herself, but sort of drawing out the implications of the idea of self, partly based on the Indian way of thinking about self during that period, and partly, I would say, drawing out from the deep, let's call it, drawing out from the deep psychological motivation that compels people to be seeking a sense of self. Okay, looking at it from the standpoint of the contemporary Indian view of self, the self as posited by the thinkers of the various Indian schools, of what they were seeking, was something that fulfilled the criterion of permanence. If something is to be a self, it has to be everlasting and has to be exempt from arising and passing away. And so then whatever is one brings forward as an attempt to identify the self, what is myself, this is myself, the Buddha says, if we look into this entity that's brought forth with the claim, this is myself, one finds that it falls into one or another of the five aggregates. It's either the body, feeling, perception, some activity of volition or consciousness. And then when we examine this particular entity that's brought forward, we find that it's not permanent, not everlasting, and even when we attend to it close up, we see that it arises and passes away. Of these five aggregates, the subtlest is the aggregate of consciousness, and generally the more reflective thinkers would take consciousness to be the self. Everything else is, might be non-self, but that which is aware is the self. But the Buddha says, look into this awareness, and we find that it too is based on conditions. It too arises and passes away. So even the consciousness is not self. Okay, so that's using the contemporary Indian standard of selfhood, that permanence is sort of built implicitly into the idea of self. Okay, then let me just bring... Okay, maybe you ask the question.
What I'm wondering then is, is he really saying, well, look, there was this compulsion of the people around me in India to believe that they have permanent selves.
Yeah.
And they don't. And the real problem is, perhaps, that they're living in terror of change.
Mm-hmm.
They can't stand the idea of change and of their own impermanence.
Yeah.
And so they feel compelled to have this view of themselves, which is a denial of reality.
Yeah.
But if that's what he's saying, then I want to know, okay, well, is it necessary to have an idea of self, that the self is impermanent and all that? Do I have to be in a panic about change so that I need to deny the obvious facts about myself and the world, that everything's impermanent? Why isn't a sense of self that is not permanent adequate?
That is.
And that would be, then, is that actually his response? Is that really what he's saying? That a sense of self that is not permanent,
yep,
is actually an adequate sense of self. Is that what he's saying?
Okay, first, before you raise the question, the point that you made was pretty much almost what I was going to say in the second part of my response to your first question, which is that I was going to deal with what is the deep psychological compulsion that compels people to adopt and advance some kind of view of self. And this is, one way to look at it is this fear of change and need, psychological need to have some permanent base of personal identity. something that I always am and always will be. And another way to look at it is the need to feel in control, to feel that one is the master of oneself. And so what the Buddha does is to bring out this characteristic or this implicit aspect of selfhood, that it involves the idea of the ability to exercise mastery or complete control over the things within our experience. And so then he points out that these five aggregates, again, one examines each one, and we find that it's not subject to our control. Whatever we take to be the self, when we examine it, we find we don't have this mastery over it. The body, the feelings, perceptions, volitions, consciousness, and therefore they're not self. Okay, do you want to ask something, or do you want to let me come to your second?
No, okay.
So then the question that you brought up in the trail of that point is whether the Buddha can affirm some kind or allow the affirmation of some kind of self which is not permanent. It seems the way the word self was generally used at the philosophical level in the Buddha's time, it implies that idea of permanence. So the Buddha will not explicitly say there is a self which is impermanent, since that would be going against the hypothesis, or let's say the prevailing mindset of the period. But the Buddha does say that he will use the word self, he puts it, the word self, he says, I use this word as a worldly convention, as well as the words I and mine and self. He says the enlightened one can use these words as worldly conventions in order to conform to the language of the world, the thought forms of the world, but he uses them without misapprehending them. And so on this basis, I would say, from a Buddhist standpoint, that we can speak about what I would call the conditioned self, the person as the conditioned self. If one wants to use the word in that sense, no harm to use the word self to refer to what we call the empirical person. As long as we don't invest that word self with the notions of some kind of permanent base of individual identity, or understand the word to imply that we have this mastery over the elements of our being.
As my understanding of this is that it's closely tied to his objections to the caste system, because the idea of the permanent self was a Brahminical idea.
Yeah.
And the Brahmins and Kshatriya and Vaishya sects, yeah, to a lesser extent, were involved in a massive effort at that time to dominate the rest of society. And part of their need to do this, the mythology that they were using to do this, was the idea that they were permanent spiritual creatures. That's what was supposed to justify the Brahmin's superiority to everybody else in the Gangetic plane. And so when the Buddha is saying, well, when he's saying there isn't a permanent self, he is tacitly denying the superiority claims of the Brahmins.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's a social movement in there. And I think that claim, see, that's the claim that's basically at the bottom of the caste system. And the people who dominate society everywhere always want to create a caste system, because it's what guarantees that their children will have the same privileges that they have.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's an implicitly anti-authoritarian view, the impermanence of the self, because it deprives the supposedly superior people of their motive for permanent superiority, and also for the superiority of their children.
Yeah.
Is that right?
It's It seems to me that there is some connection between the Buddha's doctrine of anatta, the way the Buddha goes against, at the theoretical level, the Brahminic doctrine of the self, the Atman, and the Buddhist critique of this rigid class system. At that time, it wasn't yet what we call the caste system, but it was moving in that direction with these solidified social classes. But even the Brahminic, or at least the later Brahminic view, accepts the idea of rebirth. And on those premises, one who is now a Brahmin could fall away from his Brahminhood and be reborn as a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, even a Shudra, or even an outcast. And one who's now an outcast, if he gets enough merits, he can be reborn into the higher classes, even as a Brahmin. So even with a permanent self, as long as you have the doctrine of rebirth and karma, one isn't assured of a permanent a permanent position at the top of the caste system, because one could fall from that. But there does seem to be some kind of connection. But it's a topic that would require further investigation. I can't speak with full authority about it. You have a question?
I have a question.
Okay. Okay, we'll take one question here.
I'm just trying to confirm something. Let's see if I can gather my thoughts. What's spoken of is what is being reborn, which I know a lot of people think of as a self. To me, tell me if I'm wrong, that whole notion, the whole problem of it is the grasping onto that idea.
Yeah.
And I think that it helps me, but tell me if this is right thinking.
Yeah.
You can get fooled when you use consciousness because it seems like a self.
Yeah.
That's how perception works. It's just the nature of the beast. So I tend to think of it as what gets reborn is the tendencies that one has through grasping.
Yeah.
It's the holding onto it. That's,
yeah.
And it's very ephemeral, and there's no deep point. There's no real core, although it seems like a core.
Yeah.
That's just sort of what's been occurring to me lately. I wanted to know if I was on the right.
Yeah, actually, that's expressed very well.
It also is grasping.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you meditate, sometimes I'll get a glimpse of, oh, it's like holding on like this.
Yeah.
I have a tendency to not want to be. That's just my thing. But then there's a frighteningness because it's like, oh, because it's really gripping on tight.
Yeah.
Best way I can do it. Oh, and just, if this helps anybody, this might be interesting. My father was a physicist. Years ago, he told me, everything is an aggregate. Because this, plastic, it's not solid. It's just the nature of perception. The perception's so everything is atoms. And then there's the subatomic level. It was just an interesting thing to be told as a 10-year-old kid.
Yeah.
But if that helps anybody, everything's an aggregate.
Yeah.
Everything. This goes for the universe too, not just for us.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Everything except the quarks, they say.
The quarks.
But 10 years from now, they're going to find the quarks are made up of sub-quarks. Okay, we'll take one question, then I'll try to go on to...
This is actually almost difficult for me to say, because as I've been studying Buddhism and practicing for 10 years, this has been like... That's why this is a very interesting discussion.
Yeah.
It's like the core of some things that a lot of teachers kind of struggle to answer, and then if God forbid the word soul comes up, then it's big trouble, because you know that's another debate that, you know, of course no soul, okay. There's two things, and they're the same. You know, non-self, there's a discussion of non-self, and then there's the discussion of what happens when we die.
Yeah.
It's a big thing. And you know, I studied a lot of other things, and people have these past life regressions, and they have visions of past lives, and that's clinging, you know, onto our past, you know, ourselves, because this view that what we were in a past life, and I'm confused by the whole thing, and the Buddha, you know, one of the moments of enlightenment, I don't know if I'm taught well, you know, have all these visions of all his past lives.
Yeah.
So, we don't want to cling on to the past lives, but, you know, what is, you know, there is one answer. Buddha understood one answer of what is brought forward from each rebirth. We don't want to cling on to
it. Put the microphone closer to the mouth.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the question.
I don't get the, just what, before I told you.
Well, what did the Buddha, you know, all these rebirths? Yeah. I don't even know what I'm saying because I'm so confused about it all.
Okay, okay.
But the fact that there is something that was visioned by the Buddha was these rebirths, and that was yeah. part of what he was.
Okay.
And then you have a Bodhisattva
yeah.
who is maybe, you know, reincarnation of, you know,
yeah.
some other Bodhisattva.
Okay. Okay.
So there's something carrying hold.
Okay.
And I don't want to cling on to all that, but it's my head's, you know,
yeah.
crazy.
Okay, okay. Let me try to clear this up. Okay, we read in the text, we find, you'll find it in the Majjhima Nikaya time and again, the Buddha, or at least in a few suttas, the Buddha says on the night of his enlightenment, he acquired the knowledge of the recollection of past lives, going back one past life, two, three, four, five, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, hundreds, thousands of past lives. Okay, then he teaches non-self, five aggregates, not self, how to bring these together. Again, what we refer to as our self looked at, let's say that there's two points of view, two ways to look at this. One we can call the analytical or philosophical point of view. So when we look at our individual identity from this analytical or phenomenological point of view, what we find are just the five aggregates coming together. We don't find any kind of core of our being, something that we call a substantial self, something that remains the same continuously through time. However, there is this continuity going on throughout, let's say, throughout this life, even though I don't have any core of my being that I can pull out and say, this is the real Bhikkhu Bodhi right there. But there's just these five aggregates at this moment, always changing. But still, I could remember playing football as a kid in Brooklyn, going to public school, Fort Hamilton Parkway and 52nd Street, was it? I can remember back I think I must have been 2 years old when my sister was born. Okay, so I have these memories even in this life. So how is this possible if there's no substantial self there? It's possible because there is a continuity in this stream of consciousness, that there is a flowing of the consciousness from moment to moment, and as the consciousness flows on, things that happen, things that I experience, leave some kind of impression which is preserved in the form of a potential memory. That is, I can call it up in the form of a memory. Many things are forgotten and lost. What has happened to, wait, let me continue. What has happened before 2 years old, I don't remember. But such things did happen. Okay, so my point is that in this life, there is, though there's no single lasting self, there is a continuity of experience. And because of this continuity, memories are possible. Now what is true in this life is that this stream of consciousness, the stream of experience, is occurring based on what we call the same physical body. Even this body is always changing, but it preserves some kind of relative or conventional identity. So it's the body also, it's unfolding continuously from the moment of conception right up to the present. Unfolding, once one passes the age of 40, starts to fold up again. Okay, now according to the Buddha's teaching, this stream of consciousness which arises based on this body has come into this body from persons which were existing in earlier lives, persons existing in the past. The stream of consciousness that is now occurring in this form as what I call my identity, is a continuation of a stream of consciousness which was existing in other life forms earlier. Could have been an American in the 1920s, 1930s, could have been a European, could have been an Indian, a Sri Lankan, could have been an animal, could have been a deity, we don't know. But and then that life form would have arisen dependent upon earlier life forms. So there is this stream of consciousness running through all of these life forms, ever changing, not remaining the same. It's, as she expressed it, it's a bundle of tendencies of character, interest, aptitudes, inclinations, undergoing experiences, always changing, coming into this form. And so when we look at what I am now with the eye of insight, we see five aggregates, but these five aggregates, at least the mental aggregates, are inheriting the experiences of earlier streams of experience. And then when I pass away, assuming I don't become liberated in this life, then this stream of consciousness is going to move on into another form of existence. Again, there's no permanent identity there, like a self, but the stream of consciousness continues. And the different tendencies, inclinations, aptitudes picked up in this life will be preserved in some form and will condition the aptitudes, dispositions, tendencies of the next being to arise in this continuity.
That was actually explained very well.
Take the microphone.
And that helps me a lot.
Okay, true.
I grew up in Brooklyn too. I still play basketball. So then it's possible, it's not craziness when someone might say that they have some recollection of the past lives.
No, not at all craziness, no.
That's something that is explainable under all of this.
Yeah, it's quite intelligible. And even people who say that they have past life memories, I mean, sometimes one has to be a little distrustful, because sometimes I would think wish projections get transformed into past life memories. Oh, I was Queen Cleopatra. Oh, I was Julius Caesar. I was Plato. I was Buddha. Never a farm laborer in medieval, a peasant in medieval France, or a street cleaner in 12th century Delhi.
So it's tricky business, because maybe some of these memories are legitimate and maybe some of them are some other delusion.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Okay. One question from the internet. Of all the many fetters, why does the fetter of the wrong grasping of rules and observances get broken so early at the stage of stream entry? Okay, I think this comes about because, as I said earlier, what's called the wrong grasping of rules and observances is actually the view that it is by means of these rules and observances that one can gain liberation. This was a view popular in the Indian circles in the Buddha's time, and it determined, or at least it was the principle that governed the behavior of many of these ascetic communities, where they would inflict torments upon themselves and undertake these extreme practices like fasting for weeks on end, sleeping on beds of thorns, bathing in the ice-cold water at the break of dawn, with the idea that by tormenting themselves, they would build up a kind of spiritual power that would enable them to break out from the realm of delusion. And the Buddha tried all of these practices and found that they were not successful, they were not effective, and so he rejected these types of practices. Okay, so this is a view that by these extreme observances one could gain liberation. And so the stream enterer has practiced the Noble Eightfold Path and gained the first stage of enlightenment through the Noble Eightfold Path. And so he now knows that the way to liberation is essentially through wisdom built upon a foundation of purified moral practice and samadhi or concentration. So he knows that sila or virtue, virtuous behavior, concentration and wisdom form the way to liberation. So now he no longer can adopt the view that it is through these extreme observances that one could gain liberation. Okay, any further questions? Okay, one more back here.
It's very basic. I'm not familiar with the five aggregates, and particularly volition. Is that ego, would you say?
No, the volition is, we call this volitional activities, the activities of will, what lies behind the acts, whatever actions we do, the mental force. As we go through, we'll come to the five aggregates. So just stick with us and we'll come to them.
You mentioned that in talking about, you mentioned Atman as an idea of self.
Yeah.
And the way you described it, it almost sounded like it was an individual self, and yet my understanding of Atman is that it is one Atman.
Yeah, yeah.
Not like individual.
It seems that in Indian thought in this period, there were different views of self. Some took the self to be a plurality, for each individual to have their own individual self. The view that dominates in the Upanishads is the view of that there's one universal self which is reflected in each individual self or each individual person. So there are actually a whole variety of views of the self in the Buddha's time. Okay, Nina has a question. Take.
What happens if the end total is just consciousness? What happens to consciousness when it's purified?
Wait, repeat the question.
If I understand correctly, if the end total is just consciousness, pure awareness, when the mental stream is purified, what happens to that?
Maybe let us put that question off till later.
Okay.
I'm still at an early point in covering the Majjhima Nikaya, and I can't cover everything in one session. Just a question that really pertains to what I've covered today, I'll try to answer. But I think maybe we'll stop for now. Then after the lunch period, then we'll come back for a question and answer session, if anybody has more questions. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. I think the sheet with the verses have been given out. So these are verses in Pali. When one speaks on Dhamma, listens to Dhamma, discusses Dhamma, then we quote, accumulate or acquire some wholesome karma, and we want to share it with other beings, with the deities, Devas, the Buddhas, or fear spirits, and with our departed relatives and all other beings. So I'm going to recite these verses to share the merits. akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakanto sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakanto desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakanto manparam etavata ca amhehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya pabhagupadaya vichihe tato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchanto pusanto nibbutin. Three vows for the Buddha. One, two, three.